I'm Sarah Gonzalez, and this is The Takeaway. I'm in the host seat while Tenzina Vega is reporting from Puerto Rico. She's been talking to Puerto Ricans about their reaction to the news media's coverage of Hurricane Maria 1 year ago. We'll hear that conversation later in the show. But first, in Michigan's largest public school district, students came back from the summer break this year to no running drinking water.
Testing in several buildings revealed harmful levels of copper and lead.
Elevated lead levels in the drinking water.
There are no federal rules requiring school districts to test for lead in the water. Not one. And only a handful of states have their own laws on the books mandating testing. Michigan is not one of them. And the announcement about tainted water came just days before the school year began.
Not having clean and safe drinking water certainly impedes a teacher's ability to properly educate students and for students to learn in that environment.
That's Terrence Martin, Executive Vice President of the city's Teachers Union, the Detroit Federation of Teachers.
From a Detroit teacher's point of view, this just adds to the difficulty of really performing a job. For years and years, we've fought and made national news with the conditions of our buildings, with the horrible conditions of our school buildings. So this is just, you know, one in a long line of the issues that we've had with our physical plant. And it certainly makes the job of teaching students that much more difficult.
Jennifer Chambers is an education reporter with the Detroit News, and she explains how this problem first came to light.
The superintendent of Detroit Public Schools, Nikolai Vitti, announced to staff in an email and parents that he was shutting off all drinking water fountains in all 106 schools across the district after getting test results back in mid-August that found that 16 schools did show elevated levels of copper or lead.
I asked Jennifer about the scale of this problem and if officials know how many schools might be directly affected by contaminated water.
There were 24 schools tested, according to the district. And when results came back, 16 of the 24 had elevated results.
And what is the history in Detroit? Is this the first time that lead has been discovered in Detroit public schools?
No, it's not. We only have testing information that goes back to 2016. But these buildings are, most of them are 100 years old. And as early as the spring of 2016, they did begin water testing, and they did find problems with the water back then. And they switched some schools over at that time to a system called Dehydro, which is a water purification system.
And what was the response among parents and teachers and students to this water shutdown?
I think the very first time people heard the news, they were surprised. But as time went on and we did interview families and teachers, everyone, for the most part, felt like it was the best choice to be safe, to not let the kids have access to any of the drinking fountains while tests were being done. But it did cause parents to wonder and worry, you know, how long had children been drinking at fountains at their own school, and could there have been something in there? Parents did express some frustration at needing to scramble just days before school for bottled water, but there's also a lot of families that said they sent it in anyway because their children did not like how the water tasted. But on the first day of school, I was out at several schools in Detroit, and many parents were unaware that the water had been shut off, and they did not send water in. But the district did provide drinking water in the buildings. On the first day of school, there were these Absopure-style coolers with paper cups, and bottled water was also brought in. And according to the superintendent, that will be the plan for the immediate future, for the next few months, possibly all school year, until a final plan is come up with to address the problem.
I think when people hear Michigan and lead, it automatically brings to mind the situation in Flint. Do you think people in Detroit have confidence that local authorities are capable of adequately responding to this situation?
At the school board meeting last week, many people during public comments stood up and told the school board and superintendent that they needed to replace all the pipes immediately, that this was a travesty, a social injustice, and they were angry. A lot of people believe that the problems with the water is related to aging infrastructure and that the state of Michigan neglected these schools, the physical aspects of these schools, for a decade. But if you talk to some other folks who also spoke at that meeting, they said they understood that the superintendent was addressing the problem and they were pleased about that. So there really is a mixed reaction.
And do you know, is there a timetable for when Detroit plans to fix their water problem in schools?
So once the test results come back from the remaining schools, I think that the superintendent will obviously disclose that material, and there'll be a discussion on how bad the problem is, how widespread it is. He proposed last week a fix that would cost $2 million. It's installing water stations in school buildings and clean water at the source. They'll leave the existing infrastructure in place, but put a secondary line in and attach it to this drinking station. That would come out of the district's budget, although some board members have asked that the state of Michigan pay for it because of state emergency management and the neglect that they allege was caused during that time to infrastructure.
Does Flint have something similar to this, these stations?
No, Flint does not use these water stations, but school districts in Michigan and Metro Detroit, there's two or three that do, and apparently Nicolai Vitti said that Baltimore schools uses them in all their buildings. And I would expect Baltimore has aging old schools just like Detroit does.
Jennifer Chambers, education reporter with the Detroit News. So what are the solutions here? We put that to Terrence Martin, head of the Detroit Teachers Union, who we heard from earlier.
One of the things that we certainly commend the district for doing is providing water systems in the schools. Water coolers are in schools, but still, you know, you have a school district that has to go through these lengths just to provide some of the basic needs to students so they can be focused and ready to learn each and every day.
And Terrence said that while he's hopeful, the school board is accountable to the entire community.
We've heard from our superintendent, and the information that he has provided seems to be solid. But, you know, we've been here before, and so we are anxiously awaiting a long-term solution to this issue. And it's not just teachers and students who are affected, but the community at large needs to be able to have the confidence in the school district, ensuring that children are given the opportunity to drink clean and safe water at school.
And that feeling, Terrence said, extends to schools across the country.
I think this speaks to a large issue in terms of the nationwide divestment into quality public education.
Because while lead-tainted water is an enormous problem for Detroit public schools, Detroit is not alone. Far from it. A July report from the U.S. Government Accountability Office found that 41% of school districts nationwide have yet to run any lead testing on the water.
About 18 million students are in schools that had not tested in the last year or did not know if they had tested for lead in their drinking water.
Alfredo Gomez is the Director of Natural Resources and Environment for the U.S. Government Accountability Office, which was behind this new report. He says 43% of school districts had tested for lead.
And of those that had tested, 37% of the school districts found elevated levels of lead. Now, the good news there, if there is good news, is that all of those school districts had taken actions to try to reduce the exposure of lead to these kids. So doing things like replacing fixtures, turning off fixtures, and also providing bottled water as an interim measure.
But with more than 50 million kids in public schools across the country, interim measures aren't enough, especially when you consider the potential victims.
And kids are particularly at risk because their growing bodies can absorb more lead than adults. And as we know, lead is a neurotoxin that has long-lasting effects.
And there's currently no federal requirement that schools test for lead. So what is the federal government's role in ensuring that students aren't drinking water that's contaminated with lead or copper?
That's correct. There is no federal law currently that requires schools to test for lead in their drinking water. And in the absence of this federal requirement, some states have moved forward and made it a requirement. So, for example, there are 8 states. That was the case when we were doing the work last year. There are 8 states that require schools to test for lead in their drinking water. And these states are California, Illinois, Maryland, Minnesota, New York, New Jersey, Virginia, and also the District of Columbia. Now, there are other states that have also moved forward to provide funding and provide technical support to schools for voluntary testing. So the EPA does provide guidance to states and school districts on lead. And also the Department of Education also provides some information.
And can you tell me more about the roles of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Department of Education? Are they working in tandem?
Yes. Well, so one of our recommendations was actually for the Department of Education and the EPA to collaborate further so they could encourage testing of lead in schools and in drinking water. Our survey showed that about 60% of the school districts were not familiar with the EPA guidance that related to testing and remediation. And also many of the schools didn't know where to go to. So we wanted to make sure that EPA and the Department of Education continue to collaborate so they can get the word out to school districts and the states.
And do you have any sense of why the federal government hasn't mandated this? Like, why don't they just require schools to test their water?
The federal government, the EPA, does have requirements for public water systems to test for lead. This is through the lead and copper rule. And so what happens is a school can be getting its water from the public water supply, right? And the water could be clean or safe. But what can happen is that some of the older schools might have lead piping in their plumbing. They may also have old fixtures, or they may have lead-based solder. And so what happens in schools, because of school schedules, you know, they are not open during the summer, they're closed on weekends, sometimes over holidays. What happens is that the water that's sitting in the pipes, if there's lead in those pipes or in those fixtures, it can leach out into the water. And that's how students can become exposed to lead in schools' drinking water.
And so how big is this challenge? What are some of the biggest obstacles for keeping lead out of schools?
Probably testing. You know, schools, even though there is no requirement at the federal level, some states, as I mentioned, are requiring that of schools. Other states provide funding and technical assistance so that schools can voluntarily do it. And so if it's an older school, it's probably a good idea to test to see if there is any lead in the school's drinking water.
And do you know what schools are doing in response to your findings?
Yeah, so many of the schools, as I mentioned, where we reported that they had found elevated levels of lead, had taken action. So they were trying to reduce or eliminate the exposure of lead by replacing fixtures, turning off fixtures, and then also providing bottled water for its students.
Alfredo Gomez is the Director of Natural Resources and Environment for the U.S. Government Accountability Office. Thanks so much, Alfredo.
Thank you for having me.
To Washington now, where an allegation of sexual assault against Judge Brett Kavanaugh has thrown his Supreme Court confirmation process into question. On Sunday, The Washington Post published an article with Christine Blasey Ford. She is a research psychologist in Northern California who says that Kavanaugh assaulted her at a party when the two of them were teenagers in the early 1980s. According to Ford, Kavanaugh was stumbling drunk when the assault took place. Brett Kavanaugh has denied the allegations, saying in a statement Monday, "This is a completely false accusation. I have never done anything like what the accuser describes to her or to anyone." The Senate Judiciary Committee has scheduled a public hearing regarding the allegations for next Monday. Alana Shore is a congressional reporter for Politico, and she's with me now to discuss where Kavanaugh's confirmation process goes from here. Hi, Alana.
Thanks for having me.
Alana, both Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford, the woman who accused the Supreme Court nominee of sexual assault, have now been called to testify, and those will be public hearings, and this is a big deal. Can you just talk to us about what that means?
Sure, but it's important for your listeners to remember that Dr. Ford has yet to accept this invitation. And when you really think about it, her lawyer has said that she is willing to testify in a fair proceeding. And this proceeding so far has been run and managed entirely by the GOP. It's not clear whether Democrats would even show up if this hearing happens, because they have strenuously boycotted to conducting this process so fast without what they have described as a fuller FBI investigation. So that's an important first step here, because this seems like a big deal, but a lot of moving parts continue to be still in flux, and no one on the Hill is 100% sure that this hearing will truly happen as it's envisioned.
Who made the decision for these hearings to be public, regardless of who ends up testifying? Why do you think they did that?
That was under pressure from Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee, specifically Senator Jeff Flake, who said, no, just talking to them on the phone in private is not enough. The American people deserve a hearing on this. Republican leaders were essentially forced by this handful of Republicans, led ostensibly by Flake. But Senator Susan Collins played a role, Senator Lisa Murkowski, really the swing votes on the nomination.
And so, as you said, there were a handful of Republican senators that did say that these allegations needed to be looked into by the Senate Judiciary Committee before the confirmation process could proceed. But other Republicans have complained that Democrats only went public with this allegation in order to throw Kavanaugh's confirmation into disarray at the last minute. Can you remind us of how the timeline here compares to Anita Hill and her testimony against Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas when she accused him of sexual harassment?
There are indeed some uncanny parallels between this case and the Hill case. In both instances, the woman stepped forward and said, I'm willing to tell my story, after the initial hearings had already ended on the nomination. But senators had been talking to the woman in question, at least one senator, before the hearings got started. And in this case, with Brett Kavanaugh, it was Dianne Feinstein, the top Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, who was the only senator aware of this far enough in advance. Her colleagues on the Democratic side on the committee didn't really get the full picture until last week, after a news website already had reported on the existence of this mysterious letter. So it's all happened fairly 11th hour, and it is debatable whether Senator Feinstein should have told her fellow Democrats earlier. She says, I did the only thing I could do in the situation because Dr. Ford wanted to remain confidential. What was I to do? Republicans say, well, we're not telling you to out Dr. Ford against her will, but why didn't you refer this to the FBI when you got it back in July? And the rest of the committee Democrats, because they weren't aware until the last minute, are a bit caught in the middle on this. So in that respect, it's different from Hill in the sense that really only one Democratic senator had the semi-full picture.
And how likely is it that this allegation will cost Kavanaugh votes on the Republican side of the Senate?
That's really impossible to speculate at this point. So much depends on whether and how Dr. Ford gets to air her side of the story in public, because right now, these undecided Republicans have only just heard strenuous denials from the judge.
Well, remind us how many people need to flip their votes in order for Kavanaugh's confirmation to not go forward.
Of course, in a 51-49 Senate, it takes two. That's because one defecting Republican senator will flip it to 50-50, and Vice President Mike Pence can ultimately cast a tie-breaking vote. Important to note, if Pence does this, it would be the first time in history that a vice president had to do this for a Supreme Court nominee.
And on Monday, President Trump spoke with reporters and said he was okay with a delay in the confirmation process.
We want to go through a process. We want to make sure everything is perfect, everything is just right. I wish the Democrats could have done this a lot sooner, because they had this information for many months and they shouldn't have waited till literally the last days. They should have done it a lot sooner. But with all of that being said, we want to go through the process.
Surprising from President Trump, because a lot of his allies had expected him to go after Dr. Ford. And we hear the reason that he was able to give such a measured response is that he likes how Judge Kavanaugh has been handling this. It's frankly straight out of President Trump's own playbook when women have accused him of sexual misconduct. Just deny in a vocal and 100% airtight way. That's exactly what the nominee has done. So the president was able to say, stand up guy, I support him, I'm going to stand behind him.
Alana Shore is a congressional reporter for Politico. Thanks so much, Alana.
Thank you.
And calls have been pouring in from you all on the sexual assault allegations against Brett Kavanaugh. For some of you, this cemented your opposition to Kavanaugh's nomination.
Hi, this is Karen from Florham Park, New Jersey, and I was already upset about Brett Kavanaugh, but the accusations of sexual assault are extremely upsetting. What's worse is that the people that support him, this will probably not matter to them, and the thought of that is really just devastating.
This is Daniel from Richmond, California. These are extremely serious allegations, and I'd like to be able to say that I lived during a time where the courage to speak up and be heard outweighs the need for a specific party's protocol to get someone in office.
Others were unsure whether Kavanaugh should be held accountable for an incident that happened when he was in high school.
This is Cheryl. I'm from Arlington, Texas. Everything that Kavanaugh's accused of, it happened in high school, for Pete's sake. If we held every hormone-charged young man accountable for what he did in high school, there would be no one able to pass scrutiny to serve.
But a bunch of you think that Supreme Court nominees need to be held to the highest of standards.
Hi, this is Jerry Lynn calling from Bedford, Texas. They are lifetime appointments, and we do not get to vote on them, nor do we get to choose to replace them in a few years if we are unsatisfied with their performance.
Thanks so much to all of you for weighing in. We want to keep hearing from you as the news around Brett Kavanaugh's nomination develops. You can always give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or write to us on Twitter. We're at The Takeaway.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Public pressure from Democrats continues to mount against Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which has been newly deputized under the Trump administration. And that's putting some blue cities and towns with lucrative ICE contracts in a tricky situation. Matt Katz is an immigration reporter from our local WNYC newsroom, and he's been following how this is playing out in three counties in New Jersey, where ICE pays millions of dollars each year to detain immigrants in county jails. Matt, thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me, sir.
So bring us up to speed here. First, just explain what these ICE contracts are.
Yeah, these are contracts that have been in existence for years with little controversy. Basically, ICE relies on private prison companies and county jails around the country to house its detainees. And it's been doing this in New Jersey since the 90s. But the number of detained immigrants at these jails has skyrocketed under Trump. They're bringing in about triple the number of immigrants and collecting, according to my calculations, about $6 million a month from ICE. And the most interesting thing about this is you have these Democratic counties. They're all blue counties, and they're making money off ICE. It's part of this larger controversy over ICE and the Trump administration.
Here's a clip of county legislator Anthony Venneri, who is a Democrat, being pretty frank about why Hudson County does contract with ICE.
If we didn't have the contract, our facility would be probably a third of the population. We'd have to do layoffs. We'll be hurting our own staff. I'd be hurting our own county families.
So there's an economic argument. Some of these counties need the extra money.
Yeah, absolutely. That is the argument they make. There was this unique opportunity here because New Jersey instituted a bail reform law last year that essentially diverted nearly a third of all county jail inmates in the state from jail. They're going to drug treatment programs or released under supervision instead of being locked up. This occurrence of these empty beds was perfectly aligned in terms of timing with Trump coming into office. He's now detaining more immigrants, and New Jersey has all these empty beds. And it enabled ICE to fill those beds with immigrants and enabled these counties to make some extra cash.
And Matt, you've been reporting on the mounting pressure from liberal activists and also Democratic politicians for their counties to sever ties with ICE, regardless of the economic impact, I guess. So, Matt, what is the argument from people who oppose these contracts and how are county officials reacting?
It's simply that we're Democrats and we should not be complicit with Trump's deportation machine. And by locking up immigrants who have been picked up as part of Trump's new policies, then we are being complicit. That's what these Democrats are saying. They're saying that any benefits in terms of tax dollars is just simply not worth it. They say that the county should have nothing to do with it, regardless of any cash benefits.
And if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with WNYC reporter Matt Katz, and we're talking about immigration and customs enforcement contracts in three New Jersey counties to detain immigrants in county jails. Now, usually, Matt, immigrants who are in the country illegally but who have not been accused of a crime, they go to detention centers. If they've been accused of a crime, they go to jail, of course. But there aren't enough detention centers in the country, so ICE pays county jails to house them there. Matt, have you been able to visit the immigration wing of a county jail? Can you tell us what the conditions are like?
Yeah, I've visited all three in New Jersey, and the best way I can describe the conditions is it's prison, just like you'd imagine. They wear orange jumpsuits, and they have limited outside recreation time. There's lots of complaints from them about the food. There's concern from human rights organizations about the use of pepper spray and restraint chairs to suppress immigrant detainees who act out.
So people who oppose Trump's immigration policies, they don't want their counties to do business with ICE. But there is a flip side to all of this. Here's a clip of county legislator Anthony Venneri, who we heard from earlier, on why he thinks undocumented immigrants should stay in Hudson County.
They'd be shipped to Montana or Texas, where they're not going to care about the inmates from the area because they're not going to have the families outside ringing a doorbell saying, hey, my son's in there, my father's in there, my mother's in there, help her.
So is there a legitimate argument there? Where would detainees from the surrounding area go if not New Jersey? How far could they end up?
They could end up anywhere around the country. ICE transfers detainees all the time. Now, the activists argue, hey, you know, we're going to shut down the ICE operation at this jail and then at that jail and then at that jail. And it's going to create this spiral which will force ICE to change its policies and to not detain as many people as they do now. But as you heard from Anthony Venneri there, that seems unrealistic and they're just going to be shipped off. And he has an ally, interestingly enough, among immigration attorneys. Most of the detainees are represented by pro bono attorneys. That's because New York State and New York City fund pro bono attorneys for detained immigrants. That's unusual. And there's concern among immigration attorneys that if their clients are shipped to, you know, Tennessee, that they won't get representation and they are much more likely to be deported without an attorney.
So what's the latest in this back and forth? Are these contracts still ongoing?
They are, but one in Hudson County, New Jersey, looks to be on the verge of being scrapped. There's a meeting scheduled for October in which the county freeholders, that's the county legislators in New Jersey, are supposed to vote to end the contract by 2020. They're going to do a gradual exit from the contract, and that appears to be poised to pass.
And beyond New Jersey, is this something that you see playing out in other Democratic-run jurisdictions?
Yes, I do. In fact, there have been local jails across the country, even in some areas that are redder than this part of New Jersey, that are ending contracts to detain ICE prisoners. Most recently, Alexandria, Virginia, Sacramento, California, Springfield, Oregon. And just a couple of weeks ago, Atlanta, no more ICE detainees. They're all being moved out of the Atlanta jail there. So it is something that is happening in fits and starts around the country, but it's unclear if it's amassing enough of an opposition to these detention contracts to actually force ICE to change its policies in terms of detaining people.
Matt Katz covers immigration for WNYC. Thanks for joining me, Matt.
Thank you, Sarah.
We go now to Puerto Rico, where Tanzina Vega and some of the Takeaway team are on the ground this week, reporting on an island at a crossroads 1 year since Hurricane Maria. When the storm hit, media coverage dominated mainland U.S. headlines. But for many on the island, it was darkness. No electricity, no internet, no information of any kind.
The moment the hurricane passed, you don't know what's happening. We didn't have not even a tweet to know what was going on. It was complete silence. And no phones were working, so we really didn't know what was going on.
And that's Sofia Bozzo Gutierrez, a journalism student at the University of the Sacred Heart in Puerto Rico. Tanzina sat down with Sofia in San Juan to talk about the role of the media in the days and the weeks after the storm.
Sofia, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about your experience with the storm, with Hurricane Maria, when it came here to Puerto Rico.
When the hurricane hit the island, I was at my aunt's house. My whole family was over there. We were kind of seeking protection together. But the moment the hurricane hit, we were over there. My grandmother, my grandfather, my father, my sister, my brother, everyone was in there, and we were all like really nervous and anxious, of course. And even though we had strong windows, we knew that hurricane-proof windows, hurricane-proof door, it was very stressful. You don't know what's going to happen. You feel your home is going to tear down in some way. You kind of forget that, well, you're in a safe place.
Now, you are a journalism student, so presumably you would like to pursue this as a career at some point. What was your impression of how the media covered Hurricane Maria? Did you feel that you were getting the full story? Did you feel that Puerto Ricanos were being represented accurately? Tell me what you thought as a student.
Well, yeah, that's interesting because it was complete silence. I've heard from family in the States and out of Puerto Rico that they knew the whole thing. The stories were, you know, during the hurricane, they were listening to everything, watching the news. They were really updated. But we were in the island and we didn't know what was going on. At one point, when we were completely uncommunicated, when you grabbed your phone and realized that you had no signal, you turned on the radio, because there was only one station here in Puerto Rico that was working. So we went back to radio completely. But the station was only like trying to connect people with their families. They weren't even giving us information of what was going on. So that at that point we were like, okay, something really bad happened here. We can't even hear from the police, from our governor, no one. You know, we didn't have any news.
What we're hearing from people here is that they feel, at least some people we've spoken to, feel as though there was only one side of the story represented, that it was Puerto Ricans suffering, Puerto Ricans, you know, it wasn't as much about Puerto Ricans helping each other and how they were attempting to really survive. Did you feel that you weren't seeing the full story?
Well, yes. At first, you would only see neighbors helping out other neighbors, families helping out each other. That was our help. You have to live it to understand what it was. And I was able to leave the island for a little bit after 10 days. And that's when I saw the news. And it was very difficult because we were hopeful. But when President Trump came, well, we were kind of like we lost hope, really. It was really a really hard moment because we thought like, okay, maybe he's not getting the story right. Maybe he doesn't know what's going on. Someone needs to really tell him. He needs to go into Utuado and Yabucoa and see what is happening over there, because maybe in Guaynabo or San Juan, where he wasn't really getting the whole story. And he wasn't seeing how people in Utuado had to swim across rivers to help other communities that were incommunicated and couldn't leave their homes, their area. They couldn't find water. I think the media is not separating or making a bigger deal about the fact that what happened to us because of the hurricane and what happened to us because of our political status plus the hurricane. What was happening before and what is happening now a year after the hurricane? Why are we still like this? So we feel that maybe the media is, yes, they're covering the stories. We know that people are still living in terrible situations, but what is happening? What is gonna happen? Why are we here? Why don't we have better opportunities maybe to get out of this aftermath?
Mm-hmm. Do you think a year after Maria, there has been a shift in how Puerto Ricans here feel about their relationship with the United States? Have they shifted more in favor of statehood? Have they shifted in favor of independence? Has there been a change in that awareness of our relationship with the U.S.?
Well, that's very interesting because it gets me thinking about that. Honestly, people that want statehood, well, want it even more because of the situation and how they feel we are left out and we don't have the same opportunities. But I also feel that We're also very grateful. I've spoken to a lot of people that are so grateful. I've heard so many times, if it weren't for the Americans, we wouldn't be how we are today after Maria. But there's also a lot of people that are very angry and feel like left out. They don't feel they have American rights. And maybe that anger makes them don't want to be part of the States. But what we have now, I believe it's not working.
We're asking everybody that we talk to tell us, what does it mean to be Puerto Rican today to you? Like, has your view of what it means to be una mujer puertorriqueña cambiado?
Honestly, right now, being Puerto Rican doesn't have, like, correct or political definition. You can't understand our ELA, our Estado Libre Asociado. What does that mean? Are we a state, Estado? Are we libre, free, but associated at the same time? What does that mean? If someone really understands what that means, please explain it to me. I think it's a joke in a way. And when catastrophes like Hurricane Maria come, who's going to help us? Where is our help going to come from? So I think being Puerto Rican right now is like we say in Spanish, un bache. Bache is like a space in the middle of water that you fell in that space and you don't know what's going to happen. You were walking and you fell in that space of water. And you're waiting to see, you're all wet, you're waiting to see who's going to dry you up or if you're going to be able to dry up yourself. But you need to know what's going to happen.
That's Sofia Bozzo Gutierrez, a journalism student at the University of the Sacred Heart in Puerto Rico, talking with Tenzina Vega. Tomorrow, Tenzina speaks with former political prisoner Oscar Lopez Rivera, an interview you won't want to miss.
We faced a crisis that I had hoped I would never see in my life. We are talking about neglect. We're talking about crimes. We're talking about ugly, ugly crimes. Maria is just the one that allows us to see a reality that was hidden from a lot of Puerto Ricans.
That interview airs on the show tomorrow. And on Thursday, we're bringing you a special hour from the island 1 year after Maria made landfall. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway's coverage of Puerto Rico is supported in part by the Puerto Rico Relief and Rebuilding Fund of the Partnership for New York City, funder of the Center for a New Economy, leading community engagement in the resilient rebuilding of the island. Learn more at puertoricorecoveryfund.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.